don't stop doing it. And yes, it is hard to get up in the morning, and thank God I have a hot tub because that helps a lot.
Welcome to the Guides Gone Wild podcast. What is Guides Gone Wild, you ask? This is where you'll fill your ears and minds with the stories of everyday, extraordinary women who will inspire you to take your outdoor adventure game to the next level. Whether you're starting your journey from the couch or the trailhead, this is the place for you, so let's get a little wild. Hey there, welcome to 2023. Welcome to Guides Gone Wild. This is your host, Jen, and I am so happy to be back with a total fire guest for you. I purposely picked this conversation with Anne Parmenter to kick off the year because I need to hear so much of this right now. For someone who was told by a middle school teacher that she wasn't going to amount to much, Anne has done pretty okay for herself. She will blow you right off your feet, literally. Anne is a Hall of Fame field hockey coach that took her team to the NCAA tournament multiple times. She's done multiple marathons. She's an AMGA rock climbing instructor, an ice climbing instructor. And oh, did I mention, she's also a mountaineer who's climbed a bunch of 8,000 meter peaks around the world, including summiting Mount Everest in 2006. But this is not a story of some extreme, unrelatable, genetically superior athlete ticking things off a bucket list. The day I spoke to Anne, she was on the brink of retiring from an almost 40-year career as a coach and educator to embark on her next act, doing full-time guiding for EMS in North Conway, New Hampshire. She's more of an opportunist who rarely shies away when an epic adventure potential drops in her lap. Rather than using her age or job as a justifiable reason to put things off indefinitely, Anne cranked up her mountaineering in her 40s, summited Everest in her late 40s, and decided to lean in to more technical ice climbing in her 50s. She is truly the inspiration I thought we all could use to start off the year in the right frame of mind. You're basically getting a 2-for-1 today, maybe even a 3-for-1, because I can almost guarantee your next stop will be the episode Anne did with Michael Gervais about imposter syndrome that I am linking up in the show notes. And you're also going to want to score the High Crimes audiobook from your local library. Like, seriously, my brain, like what little snow we've had so far here in the Northeast, is basically melted after listening to all this. Anne is just so dang cool. But enough out of me. Let's get some virtual fireworks going to start 2023 with Anne Parmenter. Yeah, I really appreciate you making time to do this. And I have to come out of the gate and say, I'm so intimidated right now. I'm like, I don't think I've been this nervous since I started the podcast.
Why? No, you shouldn't be nervous.
Because I was reading all about you and you have such an interesting background. But also, I think it totally triggers back to my short tenure as playing field hockey in college. And I had an Irish coach.
Oh,
who just, you know,
play?
Scared the hell out of me. I was a walk-on at Dartmouth back. It would have been 87, 88. I played for Mary Twyman.
Yeah. Small world.
I know. Totally small world. Oh my goodness. Yeah. Well, and it's just very interesting because one of the things I'm hoping we can talk about, and well, I should welcome you first of all, formally, Anne Parmenter. Welcome to the Guides Gone Wild podcast today. Thank you. So Anne is is dispatching in from her office at Trinity College, where she is the head field hockey coach and athletic head of phys ed.
I'm retiring at the end of today. We have our first NCAA home. We have a home game at 6 o'clock tonight. This will be my last game on our home field, and hopefully we advance. Yeah.
No
so
way.
That's today. And then I will be officially retiring at Christmas. And yes, Girls Gone Wild, moving up to my New Hampshire house, hopefully, and then more time to play in the mountains and guide for EMS.
Yes. We can also talk about that. That was another thing I wanted to talk to you about, because I think that Jamie Crawford connected us, and due to her connections with you folks up in New Hampshire. So I was wondering about that, because you are currently mostly based in Connecticut, but do climbing as well up there, and have been a climbing guide for EMS for a fair bit, and have
a long time.
Yeah,
I don't even know how long. So
I was like trying to figure out how you figure out how to do all the bajillion things that you do in your life and still have time to like eat and drink. But
no, there's plenty of time. I think it's busy on paper, but in actuality, you just get up in the morning and do it. So
yes, yes, that's true. Well, congratulations on your pending retirement, I'm sure. And I hope that you guys go as far as you possibly can in the tournament, just prolong it for that much longer. But congratulations, that's got to be exciting. So let's go back though, because I know that the mountaineering actually came before the, well, I should say your interest in the outdoors and climbing kind of went hand in hand with the field hockey, right? I mean, it isn't like,
I grew up in England. So just a little intro, in England, obviously the sports culture is very different than how it's structured here. And so at 11 years old, I started running for an athletic club, and you had to be 11 to be a member of the club. And I was always a little tomboy, just playing with the boys in the street, playing soccer, whatever the event of the time was. If it was World Cup, we were playing soccer. If it was Wimbledon, we were playing tennis. If yes. it was World Athletics, we were running around the circle,
Put it in perspective of the time frame, which is that, there weren't a whole lot of formal opportunities for you to be doing much of this outside of playing with your neighborhood kids because you were female.
Yeah. Yeah, but in the UK, it was never like it was here, because my mom, who's now 91, played field hockey in high school. And so the separation of like a Title IX type of situation that we've, been struggling with here for years, because collegiate sports aren't organized in the same way, with the heavy sort of money involvement with scholarships and TV rights, sports isn't organized that way in England. And so opportunities, I think, have always been there for women. It has been a little different. And it was interesting watching, the European Women's Soccer Championships this summer, because I played soccer growing up with the boys in the street, but then there was no organized soccer for me to play. That's why I played field hockey, because girls didn't play soccer, but they did, but it was kind of shunned. It was kind of looked down upon a little bit, but now that's a huge sport in the UK as well. But I had I started running, and then a teacher, when I was in what is middle school for us, I was 11, put a trip together, and I believe it was a 10-day trip up to the Lake District in the UK, which is, what I would say, rolling hills, very similar to the White Mountains, rolling hills, rocks. And she just had a passion for the outdoors, and it was a random group of kids went for 10 days. We camped in these canvas tents with, no ground sheet. And we had to dig a trench through the middle of the tent so the water could trickle down the middle of the tent. We froze our asses off, but we were camped in the grounds of what was an old church and a schoolhouse. And her friend, who was a Scottish mountain rescue guy, put this little pseudo course together for us. And we'd be, big plates of soup and stew at night. And then every day we went trekking in the hills. We got exposed to, climbing with a rope around the waist, and we learned how to belay. We did a fake mountain rescue, search and rescue. We got to sleep outside and bivvy. And I just thought it was the best thing ever. And at the time it was boys and girls. It never even occurred to me that there was any difference between us, because we just were out getting dirty and playing in the hills together. And I think that's where my interest really was sparked. And then subsequently, when I was 13, I started playing field hockey. And so I've always been, I was good at sports at school, not much else, which then sort of led naturally for me to go to a physical education college, very similar to what would be a Springfield college here in the US. And first years have to do first year camp, which is kayaking, canoeing, rock climbing, exposed again to the outdoors as a team building kind of thing, while I was playing field hockey. So I've had these kind of, what I call it, my schizophrenic life of these two activities. And then in our second year, you specialize in an area other than just phys ed. So I did outdoor education, which was, it was a great way to then go through all the coursework for what is the British Mountain Leadership Council, the BMC, which is very similar, I would say, to, in this country, the American Mountain Guides Association, the AMGA, where there is sort of structured, formalized curriculum for different disciplines within the outdoor world. And so through that college outdoor education program, we did introduction to mountaineering and We were away in the hills and navigation and map work and rock climbing. And so I got to do that through college. And again, that sort of was like really sparked my interest.
What brought you here to the States in the first place? Like, how did you wind up over here?
Yeah.
And why?
So
and you probably came and were like, what is going on here?
I know. I mean, again, a lot of these things kind of happen by accident. And through coaching field hockey, I had a friend who was coming to do a summer camp, Mierstead, which is a field hockey lacrosse camp. And there was one in Massachusetts, one up in Vermont at Castleton State College, and there was one in Pennsylvania. And an English friend of mine, they staffed that camp with foreign coaches. So the field hockey coaches were Dutch and English, and it kind of made the camp more exciting, I think, for, you know, to sell them to kids. And so I had a friend at the last minute couldn't come. And I had, you know, I was teaching, and in England, we get 6 weeks vacation in the summer. So she was like, hey, could you fill my spot? I can't go. And at that point, I had no interest in coming to the United States. It's like, you know, we had a television image of what it was like over here. And it was, you know, Hill Street Blues and Starsky and Hutch and Cheers. And I'm like, why would I go there? But I came and ended up at Castleton State College in Vermont, which is absolutely gorgeous. And we were up in the Green Mountains. It was beautiful. And I got to coach, and it was like reliving college all over again, which was somewhat wayward, but we had a hell of a time. And I came back for the second year, and some of the other coaches, there were American coaches there. They were like, why don't you come over here and go to grad school and get a grad position coaching field hockey? Because I was teaching physical education in a high school in England, in not a great school. And so after I returned, in England, all the teachers are controlled by the central government in London. So it's not like each state you have to be certified. You are certified for the whole country. Well, we are all unionized, and we were called out on strike, that all teachers. And I was like, every sports team happens after school, and those are the kids you want to work with. And so we were called out on industrial action. And I was like, I didn't go into teaching to be on strike. It was a tough time in the UK. It was early 80s and the economy wasn't good. And I had a couple of friends who were like, hey, I'm going to go to the States and get a grad assistant position and do my master's. And, you know, I was 24. I'm like, oh, that sounds great. But I didn't have one. And so I had a couple of people talk me into, well, why don't you just quit your job, come over here, spend the summer doing field hockey camps and see where it takes you. And so the plan was to come for 1 year, see if I could make it work. And as my mom to this day says, it's been a really long year, Anne, because that was 1984. I came to maybe try to go to grad school, see if I could make it work. I didn't have a job to come to, but many stories later, I'm now here. So,
yes. Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
And yeah, about to retire from your one position and double down on something else that you have interest in going on, which is awesome. God love your mom. 91, huh? That's awesome.
Yeah, 91 and still working out every day.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah.
So, and this is just some of the many reasons that I wanted to talk to you is like, I had the good fortune to catch that you had been on the Finding Mastery podcast with Michael Gervais. I listened to that and you were dropping like truth bombs left and right about, you know, what it means to age and how you interact with your environment and the types of inspiration that you find and the types of opinions you have of yourself as far as continuing to be an athlete, which I think are awesome. And I think they're going to come up as we talk more. But so you find yourself in the United States. How did you wind up in Connecticut? And when did you kind of reactivate into this, like the mountain climbing stuff that you had developed a passion for back in the UK?
So I ended up here, and then through the contacts I'd made through the summer camps, you know, and playing a sport, field hockey is a small sport, really like climbing. It's like if you know a couple of people, the network is there. Long story short, I landed a job as the assistant coach at Holy Cross in Worcester, the head coach at the time. I lived at her mother's house. Her mother owned a package store. She had me work in the package store. I played club field hockey. A friend lent me a motorbike. I drove around on that, did my GREs, met some people who were going to UMass. They said that program would really kind of go along with you know, what you're looking for, Anne, in education. So I got accepted to the UMass Amherst for the January. ended up bunking in with a bunch of people at a house who I played club field hockey with, but then I didn't have a job and I didn't realize I couldn't get a grad assistant in January. So I spent 2 weeks walking around Northampton trying to find someone to hire me, what would be illegally because I was a foreign student, and finally got a job at the Blue Bonnet Diner as a food prep, $3.25 an hour. So I worked 40 hours a week, took my classes at night until I finally got a position at Amherst College, which was room and board and a stipend. And I got a little bit more established. And then as I got into graduate school and the hockey took off, I started, you know, being like, I need connection. You know, there are outdoors here, but I don't know where to go and who to do it with. And so I managed to find a few rock climbing places, but gyms hadn't really been, you know, the advent of the indoor climbing gym wasn't there, which is now where a lot of people find their community. And so it took a couple of years before I got a full-time job at Connecticut College. And at that point, I decided I really wanted to look back at, you know, get involved with the outdoors, but I wanted to get some sort of certification over here because I didn't have any. And so that's when I found that the National Outdoor Leadership School, NOLS, I investigated their programs and I spent the summer doing the NOLS instructor program. So I spent a month in the Wind Rivers in Wyoming, completed their instructor's program. Just by chance, somebody made a donation to Connecticut College to build a climbing wall. And that was early 90s. The advent of climbing walls was happening. And so we got this climbing wall. I started teaching a PE rock climbing course. People started contacting me that wanted to use it. I made connections with local climbers. And then I found out that in Connecticut, there is just this incredible history of longtime rock climbing at Ragged Mountain, which I've been on the Ragged Mountain Foundation board for a number of years. But Fritz Wiesner back in the 30s put up really hard roots and was a pioneer in American rock climbing. And it was right here in this state and I didn't even know.
I have to say, doing the research on you was the first time I knew. I saw that you were and I know of Ragged Mountain up in New Hampshire. And I'm like, oh, and I look and then I'm like, holy cow, where are all these cliffs?
Yeah. And then there's this little diamond in the rough that there's this ridge line that follows the entire state. And, you know, the rock is of different qualities depending where it is, but the entire trap rock ridge throughout the state provides these little gems that you can find off in the woods. And, you know, it's not necessarily a destination climbing place, but people who know about it, if you can climb in Connecticut, you can really climb anywhere because the routes are old school, they're trad, they're hard grades because they were put up early when 5'9" was the ceiling. And so, you know, I got exposed to people who've been climbing here a long time, started to get into the community. And then Prime Climb Climbing Gym opened up in Wallingford. And that's where then I really started to meet other people and a small guiding company called Connecticut Mountain Recreation, who was owned at the time by Bob Clark, a longtime Connecticut climber. I met him through climbing at the gym. He asked if I'd be interested to start doing some guiding with them. And the gym hired us really to teach their intro classes because, you know, there were gyms, but nobody really was teaching rock climbing. So we used to do the intro classes, which then would give us some outdoor clients. And so I've kind of always been involved, you know, in that aspect. And then as I met more people, just for me having summers that I could work around recruiting for field hockey, just having this urge to travel and explore and go other places. And then that led to going a little bit further afield. And then I'd meet somebody and they'd come on this trip. And it just kind of snowballed completely to where we are now, where I've just opportunities have arisen and I've jumped at them.
Yeah. Well, and I want to get to the EMS thing in a minute, but I will say the other part of it that I didn't even realize until I started digging in right just recently, Jamie didn't mention anything about this, but it's a pretty big freaking snowball when you go from, you know, moving here and then all of a sudden you've climbed Everest and you've peeked out once and turned back once and you're in a book, which I just got from my library. I'm going to listen to this week because about this first failed attempt that sounds like it was a total train wreck. I'm so fascinated by this. I knew nothing about this whole adventure that these Connecticut folks put together. So I assume you found yourself in a community there that then were like kicking it up a notch and you've summited Everest.
Yep.
Holy cow.
Yeah, I
I'm
mean,
not
I
going to
was.
drop my mic because then we can't talk anymore, but it was kind of a mic drop. I was like, holy shit, this woman has gone up Everest.
Yeah,
Oh.
I mean, I was very fortunate that I was on an expedition with a group of people from Connecticut, originally down in Aconcagua, Argentina. And that was the first big mountain that I got a chance to climb. You know, it's the highest mountain in the southern hemisphere, and you know, it's 23,000 feet. And went down there, and I was with a group, like I said, from Connecticut, and two of them got altitude sick. And we had a meeting, and they're like, "We're going to turn around." I'm like, "We've only just started." And at the same time, parallel to us was a guy by the name of Jim Williams, who had his own, he's a professional guide. His company now is called Exploradus, but at the time it was Professional Mountain Guides. And we were on the same schedule. So we'd be at camp, and then Jim would arrive, and he had three clients. And we got really friendly, as you do when you're sharing base camps with people. And I went and spoke to Jim, and I said, "Hey, my guys are going to turn around, they're going to go back to Connecticut, and we've only done one trip above base camp." And he goes, "Let them go, join my trip." And I'm like, "Are you kidding?" He goes, "Sort out your food, get what you need. I could use your help, join my trip." And so I literally went back to the three guys on our ex, because it was me and three guys, and I just said to them, "I'll see you back home. I'm gonna jump ship here.
Yeah.
You guys fooling around, and I'm good. I feel good. I don't want to give up this opportunity. And if you're okay with this, I'm going to stay." And so I stayed and worked with Jim and helped his clients get to the summit of Aconcagua. And then that friendship with Jim led me to so many opportunities. And I have him to thank for that, because he also worked for Exum Mountain Guides based out in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And so after that first experience with Jim, that was a January. He said, "Hey, I'm going to Denali in June. I could use your help on that. Do you want to come?" So then I found myself off to Denali with Jim and seven Swiss Zermatt guides. It was also a train wreck, but I summit managed to summit. And then he gave me the introduction to Exum. And so I got hired by Exum. And then in 1999, December, right now, we were headed to Armor de Blanc. And that was my first Himalayan expedition. And that was with Jim. And so Jim has been this amazing connection. He was the first person to pretty much guide all the seven summits. He guided Sandy Pittman on six of her seven, but not on the very famous 1996 Into Thin Air expedition. He was there at that time. So, you know, Jim has been very instrumental in the mountaineering community for a very long time, but he gave me a lot of opportunity, and I met so many people through him. And then the Everest thing, yes, a good friend, Michael Kodas, who wrote High Crimes, he was a journalist here in Connecticut, and I knew him through the Connecticut rock climbing community. And he was the one who first pitched this whole story, about following the local couple. And you'll read more into this, that did turn into a train wreck. I
Yeah,
mean,
no
pretty much
spoilers.
people.
I don't, I'm like, I just glanced over it. I was like, oh my God, because I've read Into Thin Air, but I got the audiobook
Yeah, this
and I'm diving
will
in.
probably be a whole nother podcast after you finish
Yeah. Oh,
reading.
you got like 16 of them, I think. Yeah. Well, and I want to talk about, so the things that just jump out to me is like totally the whole, like your entire lived experience so far has been like all about grit and tenacity. And then also just the fact that you coach and teach and guide, like all of these things have so much, you know, that all has so much in common. So first, the tenacity piece of it, like, do you feel like that was just born into you, or is that something that you picked up along the line, or where do you get this ability? Like, because for most people, because, you know, spoiler alert, she's also run a bunch of marathons and like Alter does this and does that, and you're like, you just keep at things. And for a lot of women our collective ages, like just getting up every day is enough of an endurance sport and would not necessarily try to keep up all these other things that you did as in your youth. And you just keep at it and keep building on where you've been. And so where does that come from? The juice. How
Yeah,
can we
I
bottle
mean,
it?
I know, God, let's patent it, and I'll be the first to invest in it for sure, because I'm trying really hard. The elixir of the day. I mean, my grandmother on my mom's side, I mean, my family's from Scotland originally. She was a great Scottish lady. lived well into her 90s. She was a kick butt woman. And, you know, I wish, like all people, I had asked more questions. I wish I'd had the opportunity to spend more time with her. But she told me stories that my mom didn't even know. You know, when she was a young girl, she did what was like her life-saving certificate, which was the first ever offered in the country in 1908. And she was one of the first girls to ever do it. And I never knew that. And then she worked in the woolen mill, which everybody did in Hoyk, Scotland. And she got selected to get off the shop floor because she had neat handwriting and work for the boss, a man. But then when she realized at 18 that the women were getting paid less on the shop floor than the men, she rallied them to strike. And I'm like, go Nana, that's amazing. And so she, I think, was a pretty incredible woman. And at a time bringing up a family when, you know, there isn't much heat in the house, it's a coal fire and there's not a lot of food. And I think that generation and then my parents' generation, you know, the war was happening when they were teenagers, but there was not plentiful supplies of things. You learned to be resourceful. And, you know, we were brought up, the heating didn't go on. It went on Christmas Day. If you were cold, you put another sweater on. If you wanted something to do, you went outside to play and you came back in when you were hungry. And that's just how I was brought up with, that's what you do. You ride a bicycle to get everywhere. And my mom is 91 and she works out every day and she'll be flying from Australia where she lives now with my sister and my brother-in-law. She'll be flying here December the 7th and she still can make that trip. And I've got pictures of her on an inflatable snow tube going down my driveway and on the back of a snowmobile. So I said to her the other day, I'm like, Mom, do I have to keep doing this till I'm 91? And she goes, Ann, use it or lose it. And that's kind of the, if you don't keep doing this, you're going to stop.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I run regularly and I still go out and I think I'm going to break the world record. It's just, I'm lucky to be around 18 to 21 year olds that I played pickup with them last week. And I still am, I think I've got a screw loose that I'm living in this fantasy that I can still do this with this level, but I'm climbing harder than I've ever climbed. I just need to learn to be smarter about how I train. I can't do it every day. And so I alternate. I run, climb usually, but don't stop doing it. And yes, it is hard to get up in the morning. And thank God I have a hot tub because that helps a lot.
Yeah, I was wondering about being surrounded by all these kids all the time, because like, you know, what you were talking about of like, oh, you know, the heat comes on at Christmas and, you know, maybe two other holidays throughout the winter or whatever. Do you ever have this like little nagging concern about humanity when you see kids coming in that are not living maybe that same lifestyle until they get there?
I work in a very privileged, elite liberal arts college. That it bothers me every day, the waste, the just access, the wealth, in a way that at the end of a tailgate, I'm the one filling the plastic containers to take the food home to put in my freezer. And then I live off it all semester and people laugh at me. And it's like, that bothers me a lot. And the resilience, I can't throw anything away because I might be able to use it for something else. And so resourcefulness, I think this generation has lost the ability to fix things. If it's broken, you buy a new one. If it's broken, I try to fix it. But again, that's, we were brought up at a time where money was not plentiful. You know, I arrived here with £500, $700 and two bags. And I was like, I'm going to make it work. And if I've got to get jobs and multiple jobs. And if you're willing to work hard, you can make things work. And you can definitely do it here in this country. And it has given me the opportunities I don't know I would have had in the UK.
Yeah. Well, but I guess you are obviously doing something quote unquote right in that you haven't alienated all these kids around you and you're a very well, highly esteemed coach. I think it would be tough to kind of be in that environment all the time and not tend to get a little snarky or cynical or like judgy or preachy or whatever. And you're obviously not doing that because you are revered I'm going to have my kids listen to this one because no matter what I tell them, they just...
No, you have to hear it from someone else.
No grit. I know. Yes, exactly. Exactly. So let's talk a little bit about then the other piece of it that jumped out at me is like, there's obviously something in you that makes you enjoy and be good at helping people in that way, you know, whether it's teaching climbing or coaching and, you know, and honestly, the ability to make good decisions, take the macro look view, I guess, like, cause I think that's important to both mountaineering as well as coaching. Like you have to be able to step, you know, you have to be able to focus on what's in front of you, but also maybe how it plays into a bigger picture. Is that something that you feel like was inherent, or is that something that you feel like you've developed over time? And if so, how?
I mean, I'm thankful every day that I've had the opportunity, you know, and it sounds so corny, but I know what 3 years of teaching PE in an inner city school felt like, and having the Sunday night syndrome of like, I got to go back to work tomorrow. And it was a grind, and I only experienced it for a short time. I feel, you know, yes, I come to work, but tonight, you know, we got a game at 6. I won't leave here till whenever. And then if we win, we're on the road all weekend. I truly don't feel like I've worked in the sense of going to a job where I punch in. And so I've been very fortunate that what I do every day is I get to share something I'm super passionate about. And it doesn't matter if it's climbing or coaching field hockey or just teaching a PE course. I have been able to live the thing that I wasn't gifted in the classroom. But, you know, I can play sports and I get a lot of joy out of just physically feeling the goodness that makes you feel like. And whether it's walking up Mount Washington in the winter, for some people, that is going to be the biggest accomplishment of their life to deal with the weather and the cold and to be able to help facilitate and share in that experience, to see my team when they have a great performance and to push people. And I've always had such joy being able to push people beyond where they think they can perform. And I think it makes you realize you can truly do anything if you set your mind to it. And then you've got to put 10,000 hours in and you've got to work at it all the time. And I appreciate the people that push me. And so just that sharing is just something, I don't know. My sister is driven as well. And so I think it's just what we have, but we have a really hard time sitting still. That's sometimes, and yeah. You know, it's like when you stop, you know, I mean, if we're not doing all of this, then we're doing construction at home and major building projects. And it's like always working. And I don't know where that now, could we just like sit down for 5 minutes?
Right. Right. Yeah. I think there's a lot, it's been interesting to meet a lot of folks, you know, like my age, a little older, that you think to yourself, yeah, maybe 40 years ago, if like we were, you know, the age we were 40 years ago now, we'd probably be medicated into submission somewhere, but you know, nobody had any idea what to do, especially with the girls back then. They're like, oh, I don't know.
I make that reference every day because many of my athletes are on some kind of ADD type of medication and you know, my school report was if Anne would stop looking out the window wishing she was outside, she would do much better in school. I would be an absolute candidate for something like that. And it horrifies me to think that we are dumbing down in order to get people. It's like, wait a minute, isn't that just a youthful exuberance of life? Why should that be medicated? And so yeah, I think the whole medication is a whole nother series. Yeah.
Yet again, that's like our sixth podcast, the spinoff that we're going to do. So let's talk about how you started working with EMS. Where did that come from?
So the small group Connecticut Mountain Recreation, you know, existed within Connecticut. And then that dissolved. And I wasn't working for anybody here. And then Eastern Mountain Sports had locations throughout Connecticut, and Eastern Mountain Sports has gone through lots of different ownerships. And at the time, a climber by the name of Matt Shove, who now runs his own guiding company, Ragged Mountain Guides, Matt worked for Eastern Mountain Sports. And so he was the Connecticut person running out of West Hartford, where there was a store and a climbing school. And so we have these different locations, the Gunks, North Conway, Connecticut. And so Matt was hired to be full-time and to drum up a little bit more business and visibility. Like you're saying, you know, a lot of people don't know about Ragged Mountain because it's just not advertised out there. And so it was through my connection with Matt that he was like, you know, I'm trying to get more people on board. So then I started working more out of the West Hartford office here. And then because I was working out of here, we would do, you know, annual trainings where all the schools would get together. So the school from the Gunks and North Conway, And then over the last 7 years, I've had a place up in North Conway. And so Keith Moon is the head of the climbing school overall. And there's a, you know, there's a lot of work in the winter. So EMS's main season up in North Conway is the winter. Obviously, it's a mecca for winter sports. And so I started picking up weekends up there, being able to be up there more, started ice climbing myself, which I hadn't done a lot of technical ice. It would have been mountaineering, ice axe type of stuff. So went through the AMGA ice instructors program, get all the certifications, and started being part of, you know, the team up there. And then, you know, the climbing down here, the EMS, like the storefronts have gone, but we still do run the rock climbing, you know, if and when people contact the school. So when I'm here, I do stuff here. And again, it's juggling this, but yeah. The winter is mainly where I've done most of my work with them.
Yeah. And I do want to reinforce, let's put a little pin in this. When did you start doing all this technical ice climbing? At the ripe young age of?
Like 53, maybe.
Look at that. You started something new in your 50s. Imagine that.
Yeah. I mean, I've been doing it, but not like doing it. So put a lot, you know, I've been putting a lot of time into just swinging ice tools and got a tremendous group of guys who I climb with who, again, much younger. And my whole thing is if I'm going to hang with them, I have to be able to perform and physically be able to stay with them when you're hiking up into the ravine. And it's like, no, don't carry the rope. I got to carry my own gear. And it's, yeah. It's like you got to grind it out.
Yeah, but it can be done. Do you know Lori Watt up there in North Conway?
Well. Lori and I climbed together. We're good buddies.
So, yeah, because she was kind of somebody I talked to early on, and immediately your story reminded me of hers. Except she kind of even got into it later, like in general. And I was like, I figured you guys must know each other because it's a pretty small universe, and then the women who do it are probably a very small universe. So.
Yeah. Now, Lori and I, we rock climb together. We ice climb together. We've become really close, and especially just the support for women, I think, is really important because, to your point, there aren't a lot of us out there. And so especially supporting women as they are trying to do this often after having another career, you know, Lori, physical therapy, myself, you know, I've had this as a parallel thing, but really diving into it, you know, and wanting to share our experience. Not only with other women, with men as well, but being very conscious of it's an intimidating activity to get into as you get older. And so, you know, Lori has been really successful in offering a lot of women's programming and just providing women need different things. You know, they want the sort of sisterhood of being in a group that's very supportive together in a different way than if you had a group that were just guys. Yeah, giving that experience, I think, is really, really empowering.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed. So that brings me actually to want something I'm curious about. Like, what is your favorite type of group or like what do you get super jazzed when you see that that's on your agenda for that day for climbing?
I'm very conscious, especially in the winter, you know, the technical ice, the steep, long, super hard, that's the young guys can do that. And I'm very conscious of I'm not going to box above my weight class with people that are clients. And so I might go out and push as hard as I can in order to maybe up the ante for me as I get better. I want to be able to provide everybody with a very rewarding experience. But as we shy away from using the word safe because we're working in an environment that's very dynamic and we can't control it, but as safe as possible within the realms. And so I've worked with groups of women. I've worked with kids. Kids are challenging sometimes. In the winter, it's too cold often. But beginners, as frustrating sometimes as it is, being able to manage a group of beginners when it's 10 degrees out and still give people a good time. And then those days on Mount Washington where it is just gnarly as all get out. And you might not even summit, but people realize we got to turn around. And they're like, come on, we want to go to the summit. And you know,
it's called guiding. It's not called summiting.
we get to Lion's Head and I'm like, all right, we'll give it a go. And the minute you step out from the protection of Lion's Head Rock, they learn pretty quickly when they get picked up off their feet that this is a decision that is beyond you. You cannot physically continue because you're getting blown off your feet. But putting people in that environment and then realizing, like teaching people how to dress properly and how to eat properly and things that you can do, yeah, that just gives me great pleasure to share that you can do it in this amazing arena of the outdoors.
Yeah, no, for sure. So before I kind of close out and ask you a couple of fun questions, I do want to bring back one thing that I heard you say in this interview that I listened to earlier today, which is that somebody who is as accomplished as you are on so many different fronts on occasion has a struggle with imposter syndrome that harkens back to things that you were told when you were a child. And I want you to talk about this. If you remind no other person but me how to be careful with language in front of my children, then you've done your job. Because I really, every time I hear it, I'm like, oh yeah, I gotta, you know, and I just was so shocked by that. But at the same time, I'm like, yep, you know what? So much truth to that. So recount this story that, if you remember it, that I heard you say.
Yeah, pretty clear. Myself and my sister went to the same school growing up in the UK. And for me, it was the first year through a new open plan style educational approach, which obviously didn't work for me. And we had an English teacher who we had to, you know, introduce yourself. You're 13 years old. Hi, my name's Anne, and this is what I want to be when I grow up, kind of thing. And at that point, I realized I was good at sport. And when I found out that you could actually be a PE teacher and get paid to like teach other people sport, I'm like, wow, that's what I want to do. So I remember very clearly in that class, yeah, my name's Anne Parmenter and I want to be a PE teacher. And this teacher was like, Anne Parmenter, you're never going to go to college. You're not smart enough, in front of the entire class. And remembering that really clearly, my sister following 2.5 years later, oh, you're Anne Parmenter's sister. Do you think you're going to college too? Because she's not. And I would love to go back and knock on this teacher's door, because now as I'm older, I realize at first, you know, you want to be like, what the? I want to knock and just say, thank you. I am now a full faculty member at Trinity College. That probably motivated me in a way that at the time I was so mad and pissed off, but didn't realize because I was 13. But at 13, I knew that I wanted to be a PE teacher, and whatever it was going to take academically to get there, I was going to crawl to get the exam results to get there. I got to college. I got here. I'm still waiting for a tap on the shoulder that I have no idea what I'm doing on the sidelines here, and I've managed to fool everybody for 36 years coaching field hockey, but no one's tapped me on the shoulder yet. But I think being in the environment with mostly male guides, that's where the drive to you cannot be physically weak. You cannot be the person that's at the back of the line, because that is ever, it's present every day that you're always battling that you belong. And so it's real for sure. And I think for so many of us, when we're told we can't do something, you either run from it or you work harder.
Right. Yeah, I guess that's what struck me so much too, is that, you know, you are fortunately the kind of person who fights, but even being that type of person are still constantly revisiting it in the back of your head, because it does something to chip away at your, you know, at your, I don't know, confidence over time. And also just to people who have run away from the get-go from it, you know, don't think that those among us who seem like they have no cares in the world and aren't, you know, are just powering through and getting it all done, don't think that those people think they have it all figured out either, because they don't. So
I had an opportunity here at Trinity to teach a first year seminar, which is an academic seminar. And I called it the Mountain Experience. And we had 14 students in the class. I got to have a TA. But what we did was I had 14 students, because each student had one of the 14 8,000 meter peaks of the world. And we chose a reading list of lots of contemporary mountaineering books. So High Crimes obviously was one of them. Into Thin Air, Touching the Void, things that had great discussion points, you know, in Touching the Void, do you cut the rope or not? Things like this. But I volunteered to teach this course because I knew it would probably be one of the hardest things that I was going to do. Because a first year seminar is a writing intensive course. It's a way to introduce first years to the research library, the writing center through your course. And the whole time that teacher's voice was in my head. But for me, I want to be the teacher that is not that. And so being really conscious of how I speak to people in the class. And I think as hard as that lesson is, that was a really tough thing for me to do, to be reading people's papers, grading papers when I had this voice the whole time. But trying to do things, they say, you know, do something that's difficult every day. I think we all get very comfortable and we do the comfortable. Train your weaknesses, climb the climbs that are uncomfortable for you. I'm horrible as an off-width climber, so climb more of them, you know, run a bit faster and you'll be surprised. It is hard to remind yourself that, but saying yes to things that I know is going to make me really uncomfortable, doing presentations, doing speeches in public around really high professional people, you're like, whoa. And then I think it keeps you ticking.
Yeah, I totally agree. And, you know, and have grace when there are days that you don't opt into that stuff. And that's okay. That doesn't mean you shouldn't just start from the beginning and reassess the next day and maybe take the opportunity. So yeah, no, I'm all fired up now. You got me all inspired. So thank you very much. So you alluded to this project where people were picking all the 8,000 footers and all this. Like, is there anything that's still on your bucket list that you haven't gotten to yet that you're like, there's this one peak?
I mean, I had a chance to this spring go back to the Himalayas with a group that I was with when we summited. There's a friend of mine, they're going to climb Kanchenjunga. And, you know, just there's part of me that would love to see, you know, do I have another 8,000 meter peak in me at 63? Do I want to do that? Do I want to spend $30,000 to go to one peak? Do I want to have some smaller objectives with friends where it's just really enjoyable? And so I've decided I'm not going. Partly that is, you know, I think I need a little bit of time to figure out this retirement thing and how that's going to play in, and maybe just get some time in to take a deep breath and figure out, yeah, I'm going to go climbing in the Dolomites in June. I'm going to go do some other things. And I don't have a bucket list. Like, Everest was never on a bucket list. It just presented itself. I've never been this person who's ticking things off. I want to see if I can run another full marathon, and I haven't done one for a while. You know, the training involved, me and my training friends are like, do we still have another one in it? So I'm okay with things that are local. I don't need, to your point, I'm not looking for notoriety. I never have. I just quietly grind away, and I've got some climbs that I'm like, yeah, I want to try to lead a bit harder than I have. So just go out and do it. So those are the things that I, you know.
I like, it isn't a bucket list. It's like what Always sounds dreaming. Interesting to me? What's going to jazz me up? Yeah. I just think that, like, being driven by like, wow, this is something I've never done before. And it sounds spectacularly awesome. And this opportunity fell in my lap and I'm going to take advantage of it. Like, that's not a bad way to live.
Yeah. I mean, I've got, you know, the Kulin Ridge on the Isle of Skye is something that I've spoken about with a couple of my friends. And, you know, I was on the Isle of Skye as a child with my parents. And that's just something that I'm like, I would love to go and complete the Kulin Ridge. Why? I don't know. Just because it's been there. The Talisker Distillery is at the end of the ridge as well. That might be a good goal. But, you know, some things like that, maybe that
Who
will
knows?
Happen.
Maybe your mom will come with you.
Absolutely.
I don't see that as being out of the question, which I think is freaking amazing. Oh,
well,
my gosh.
My mom climbed Ben Nevis with me in Scotland, the highest mountain in the UK, when she turned 70. And I'd never climbed it before. And we did it. It was the summit was a little bit of a whiteout. And so she was like, yeah, I'll do that with you. I mean, it's a hike, but it was still pretty full on.
Well,
game.
You do have to up the ante. I read your essay about what you did the year you turned 60. And I was like, oof, dang, that's like my life in a you did it in a year, not even. So, and then my last question I want to ask you, just because I like to ask everybody this because I'm curious, is what is your favorite piece of outdoor gear that you have that cost less than $50? Could be useful, could be fun, whatever.
Wow. I'd have to think about that. Less than $50, best piece.
Best, most useful. I just like to get it like, because obviously, if you just said what your favorite piece is or your most useful piece, it's very easy to come up with something regardless of your sport. But there's a lot of sports that people think cost a lot of money to get, you know, something valuable out of. So,
yeah, I think for me, I think, and $50. I mean, I do a lot of shopping at thrift stores. And so I can pick up, I mean, a piece of Ragged Mountain equipment, a hoodie on sale was less than $50. And these lightweight R1 style tops are the bomb for so many things. I have a pair of soft shell pants that I got from TJ Maxx that I wear all the time for climbing. Yeah. and I'm embarrassed that I've had them for so long. And then I got to say, once you can afford to buy decent mountaineering boots, they're more than $50 for sure. But for winter stuff, I've learned now you get what you pay for. So when you scrimp, you're going to be freezing.
Yeah, that is a good corollary to this, is that there's certain things that you should not cheap out on, yeah. Period. Yeah.
So I think a really decent rain jacket. And again, you can find this stuff. There's a thrift store in North Conway that I don't know who's turning their stuff out, but I benefit a lot from. But footwear, like a really good pair of, you know, I wear Sportiva, either approach shoes or sneakers. So things in the mountains like that help you move really quickly and efficiently are really good. And as far as actual pieces of equipment, like get a comfortable harness, one that fits and you're really comfortable in, I think is key. And I'm sure when we hang up, I'll think of something and be like, dang, why didn't I tell Jen that? I should have told her. And I think for women, a backpack that fits you.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's something I've come into appreciation of lately. It was just like, yeah, it could, and I think unfortunately when you're a female with a lot of this gear, you go in and you ask somebody's advice and they give you something. And if you've never done the activity before, you don't know any better. And so you're sitting there like, you know, like my bike is wrong size. Everything's the wrong size. And I'm so aggravated now.
A men's small is not going to work, even though that's what fits you, you know, I mean, so fit and is often key. But I think for me, under $50, what's a game changer? Get a wind blocker hat, because if you have a really good wool wind blocker style hat and a decent pair of gloves, you can do a lot.
Yeah, good. That's good. That's all good. All right. Awesome. This has been amazing. And I'm only marginally less intimidated than I was when I first got on the phone with you, but you're the coolest human being. And I'm so excited that you and Lori are friends, because someday I'm going to meet her in person too. And hopefully you'll both be together at the time. And because I love her and worship her too.
Lori's doing an event. It's part of the Women's Climbing Coalition, January 21st.
Okay.
I think I'm working with her on that one.
Awesome.
We should try, at least the three of us, let's get together for a coffee or a beer or an activity. Or
absolutely.
That would be amazing. My plan is my place here will be sold and I'll be living up there full time, which is what Laurie's doing. So we're on the same kind of track.
That would be super cool. I look forward to that.
Yeah, I'd love to meet you. And I think the thing for me often, because I, you know, I'm doing this, the climbing stuff is part-time. And so you're part of a community that you're in and out of. So even just being accepted by that community, by the full-timers as legitimate, mm-hmm. you're a part-timer, that's a whole nother like interesting dynamic.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't know. Now you're going to go full bore on that, just like you go full bore on everything. And
but the thing is, you know, honestly, to make it work in guiding, if you don't have work all the time, I've been able to make this work because I have a full-time job that I can also do this, because, you know, the health benefits and a retirement, you know, how can you do this if you don't have those things? It's really hard. It's really hard.
Yeah.
But anyway. All right. Yeah, I got to run. But
yes.
It's been
great. Thank you so much. This was amazing. I appreciate this so much. So for those of you who have been on the edge of your seat for 45 minutes waiting to hear how Trinity did the day I talked to Anne, they beat Catholic University and were victorious against the College of New Jersey in the second round the following weekend. But Anne's final season ended when Middlebury beat Trinity 3-0 in the quarterfinals on November 13th. But still, not a shabby way to sail off into the sunrise of her new New Hampshire life. And speaking of next chapters, it is officially Planuary. What are you going to get up to this year? If your dream list includes some climbing, you are in luck. I've got even more inspiration for you with a few clicks of your mouse. Head on over to the podcast page on guidesgonewild.com. All you need to do is hit the climbing filter link, and you will have more than enough to listen to at the gym or on your next road trip. Wendy Elliott, Lori Watt, Erin O'Toole, Haley Deep, Anissa Lucena, and so many more. You can listen right there on the episode pages or head over to your favorite podcast player to download them for the road. Definitely check it out. Or if you're more fired up to hike, paddle, ski, hunt, surf, fish, whatever, I've got it. I've got you. Easy, quick links for all. And in the spirit of getting my butt kicked into gear by Anne and her tenacity, keep your eyes on the Guides Gone Wild website and your ears on this podcast for some announcements that will be coming up. We've got some cool events that we're working on for 2023, as well as some ways for you to get to know each other and hook up with adventure besties and accountability partners. So much good stuff to look forward to for me, and I hope you'll be excited too. Thank you all for joining me today, and as always, I look forward to another year of getting wild with you all.